If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Well, you'll try.
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at the Academy Award-winning No Country for Old Men. Starring Tommy Lee Jones, Josh Brolin, and Javier Bardem, No Country for Old Men wrestles with the themes of fate and morality and the lack of both. Also, monsters with bad haircuts. With me to discuss this film, as always, is Dr. Anthony LaDon.
The haircut and that face?
Yeah. Yeah, the strangulation scene. I'm so glad you sent me a clip of that.
Oh my gosh. That scene is like, most of that scene, you don't see his face. And it lasts for a while. And I've gotten to the point where it's like, here comes the face. Here comes the face. Steve, are you the kind of guy that recognizes / notices the musical score of a movie?
Well, I would think so. I reckon.
I'm not. I don't. I will only recognize it if it's bad. It's like a umpire in baseball. It's like, if it's done well, it'll just kind of do what it needs to do to me emotionally. But I won't like notice like, oh, that's quite nice, or that's an interesting choice. Like, I guess most of the time when I'm watching movies, I don't want to notice that kind of stuff.
Huh, really?
But why you're not the kind of guy that's like, oh, that's probably John Williams or something.
Yeah, and I like to listen to, I think it's all part of it, right? I mean, if it's working, it's like when you enjoy like good camera angles, right? Why wouldn't you enjoy the score?
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing I wouldn't notice. Like, if I'm going to assess something critically, like if I'm prepping for a podcast or something, or using a scene in a writing project, I'll turn that part of my brain on, but I would prefer not to. I would prefer to just let it do its thing and for me to live inside of the story.
But what about, like, say, like a Birdman, where the score becomes so essential to the creating the frenetic energy?
Yeah. If it's doing what it needs to do, all that it is for me is part of my emotion.
Well, you don't typically enjoy music.
That is not true. That is certainly not true. It doesn't dominate my life. I don't need a musical soundtrack to my life. But I guess my question is, if a musical score is working for me, I tend to not think about it very much. Whereas you would sort of notice it and sort of like, kind of file it away as something else that's interesting about whatever you're doing.
Yeah, you know, and I probably know more famously on this podcast discussing the music, say, for like a John Carpenter.
Yeah, okay. And I will notice a good needle drop. You know, a good needle drop for me is like a hey, look at me moment, you know, whereas I feel like most of the time a score is sort of there to, I don't know, tell you what kind of mood to be in.
Did you feel that way when you were watching Severance? Or were you more in tune to the score at that point? Just
when I'm into it, when I'm like, when I'm sort of like experiencing,
doing a close reading, you might notice it more than.
Yeah, yeah. If I'm like in the story, if I'm experiencing the emotions that the people in the scene are experiencing, if I'm feeling the energy that the director wants to convey, I don't hear the music in that way, on that conscious level. Mm.
Yeah, see, I can be sometimes obnoxious about it, like the movie There Will Be Blood. I love so much, and there are moments in the score where the score is like feels like it's got a speaking role almost.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll like stop the movie to explain to whomever I'm watching it with how great it is, and they usually don't like that part of.
No, you're an asshole.
For sure.
This is not a popular opinion, but I hate the score in Lord of the Rings. It just feels oppressively repetitive, and I just feel like they could have used it like 80% less, and that would have increased my enjoyment. Or mix it up.
Not enough slide whistle for me.
Sure. So
to the convey first time, when things get whimsical. Whoop, whoop.
So when you first watch this movie, because you do notice the score, did you notice the lack of score?
Yeah, it's interesting because I it's funny as you're talking about this. I was like, man, was I negligent in the music in this? Because I just like did like rewatched a few scenes just before we started here, and it's like, yeah, it's quiet, man. It's like distressingly so, right?
This movie,
because like a lot of horror movies will do that, right? Where they will drop sound, drop score, and that's usually a clue.
Yeah,
that something like you're getting ready for a jump scare kind of thing.
Yeah, no.
So this whole movie does that, right?
This whole movie is getting you ready to be frightened.
Well, and because it puts you in a, and it's like, and we'll get into this because I mean, there's so many elements of this film that are antithetical to a film.
Uh-huh.
And that's how it works, right? So I mean, I think it's. So I think this is a good jumping off
part. Yeah, one of the most remarkable things about this movie to me is that there's absolutely no musical accompaniment except the mariachi band when he wakes up. But that's something that's happening in world. Like the main character hears that. He has interactions with the musicians. It is what wakes him up. Otherwise, there's no music to tell me how I should feel. And I'm on the edge of my seat the entire time. Just utter confidence for a filmmaker to say, like, no, that's enough. What we've done with the camera and the dialogue and the sound mixing, that's enough. We don't need that extra layer to like script the emotion for the audience.
And it's funny you say like edge of the seat, because like the movie does this where you're on the edge of your seat and then a moment later you'll be like, wait, is there even a seat to be sat on? I mean, like, because you're just, it's fascinating how much tension sometimes lies in the lack of it too.
Sure. I'm gonna play this is a very famous scene.
Well, isn't this a seat of yours where I'm from? Friendo.
I didn't mean nothing by it.
Didn't mean nothing.
Just passing the time. If you don't want to accept that, I don't know what else I can do for you. Might it be something else?
I don't know. Will there?
Is something wrong?
With what?
With anything.
Is that what you're asking me? Is there something wrong with anything?
Will there be anything else?
You already asked me that.
Well, I need to see about closing then.
See about closing?
Yes, sir.
What time do you close?
Now. We close now.
Now is not a time. What time do you close?
Generally around dark. At dark.
You don't know what you're talking about, do you?
Sir?
I said, you don't know what you're talking about. What time do you go to bed?
Sir?
You're a bit deaf, aren't you? I said, what time
that
do you
scene
go to bed?
Feels as scary. It almost feels as violent as anything else in the movie.
Right.
Even
in fact, the violence, for the most part, there's a couple of scenes, but like for the most part, the violence is so abrupt or off screen that those scenes become like they're jarring, but not nearly as tense and unsettling as this type of scene, right?
This guy, the coin, because of the coin flip, this guy survives, right?
Yeah.
But I kind of feel like this guy was just as victimized as anyone else in the movie. Like this poor guy is going to think about this moment for the rest of his life. He's going to have nightmares about this conversation with this ghostly, crazy, villainous face.
Well, and it makes you, because it does a couple of things. One, it it's like almost a torture of control.
Mm-hmm.
And but the other thing it does,
he's breaking his spirit in that right. In the course of like 1 minute, this guy is completely subservient.
Without any physical harm being done to you, I could see you for the rest of your life with sort of a PTSD of just the idea that like, wait, yes. You mean this could happen for no reason? And this is the point, right? I mean, this scene, I think, encapsulates everything that this movie is about, or, you know, and the Tommy Lee Jones character is wrestling with, and the idea that there is no rhyme or reason to good. There is no rhyme or reason to bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you come face to face with it, it's like until you, like, you go through life, you're the main character of your own life. But there's
until
this crossroads.
Until you meet Anton Chigurh.
Until you meet Anton Chigurh and you go, oh, wait, I'm a footnote in his story.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a bigger concept of just this idea of like, we you know, whether you have a religious background or you know, you just sort of, you know, you kind of understand the concept of just film or novels, whatever it may be, we kind of all just embrace this idea, whether it's a higher power or just some sort of notion of order, that everything is kind of makes sense and I get to be a part of this and I have agency. And, but then the problem is if you drop a world full of people with agency, agency becomes very muddy because we're still now at each other's whims, so to speak. And when somebody steps out of the rule, and we hear that when he says, if the rule brought you here, what good is the rule? And that, like, that's another way to kind of sum up this whole idea of like, what's the point? And there is this like, that's kind of like the sad moral of the story as we jump to the, you know, one to grow on is just, what's the point? Probably none.
I think that there's something, well, to wrap up the music conversation, I just think it's amazing that scene has no music. In fact, the whole movie basically has no music. And, you know, even just playing that clip for you, I feel on edge, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, for sure.
it's just that voice, you know, never mind the face, but the voice itself and just the complete mastery over someone else's will, it feels like torture. It feels like torture to hear that guy in that conversation.
Well, and two, what happens is a lot of times in movies, if you have a scene like that and there is no music, because it's not completely atypical that a scene like that wouldn't have music, but then there would be music following to sort of give you relief or some sort of a sense of what's going to happen next or how to transition to a scene that, but because it doesn't, you're like, is he going to go back? You know, is this like, is he just going to come back later? And that's the thing is I couldn't rest. Even if he left, I'm like, well, how did I know? How do I know that guy is going to be like true to the coin flip?
I do want to talk about the concept of the coin flip and fate and agency and all that. Before that, I want to make a bold claim about this movie. Let's see what you think about this. I think this is the best Western that isn't an anti-Western.
You don't think it's an anti-Western?
I don't think it's an anti-Western. I think the sheriff is basically a good guy. He wears a white hat. He rides around looking for a guy dressed in black who's evil. Like, where's the anti-Western part of that? It doesn't end.
I'll tell
like
you exactly where the anti-Western part of it. Do they ever encounter each other?
That's a good question. It's possible that they do.
And it's possible. Well, it's possible. I think the important thing, the reason why I take this as an anti-Western is that it's, I feel like it's intentionally creating Western tropes to disassemble them.
I mean, the end for certain departs from not just Westerns, but most movies. Most movies do not end the way that this ends. Well,
we've talked about Westerns in terms of sort of this Americana notion, right? This idea that, you know, we almost associate cowboys as much as we associate the founding fathers in terms of how this country is established. And while, you know, certain Westerns look at the sort of the corrupt underbelly of sort of the Wild West, at the end of the day, we feel like we know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. Mm-hmm. Now, Llewellyn complicates this pretty dramatically because Llewellyn is it's so interesting. So you have like an Anton Chigurh who sort of presents this amoral character.
Okay.
But you could make the argument that Llewellyn sort of falls in the same category. Like he may be, he's trying to do good against a worse guy. He's not, I mean, his intentions and he moves things in such a way where everybody around him is in jeopardy, right?
I don't think Llewellyn Moss is the main character of this story. I think that...
No, but he's a central figure.
He's central figure to illustrate a point. The story begins with the voiceover by Tommy Lee, and it ends with a little monologue by him. And I think that the story does have a good guy and a bad guy. It also has a guy in between. It does play with the idea of a heroic past, which Westerns will do. And, you know, it certainly...
I don't think it does. I think it romanticizes a notion of a historic past.
I think there's different characters in this movie with different takes on this. But I think for most of
that's
the
it.
Film,
I think they're wrestling with this idea.
Yes, that's right.
And so the thing is that it's a reckoning of sorts.
Yeah, right? I like that.
And I think... So I think in a way you've created a modern, so in the sense that it's a Western, yes, but in the sense that I think it's yes and I think that might actually go quite into the theme of this entire film, which is like, yep, it is those and it isn't at the same time. Like, I feel like there's a lot of that, right? Like there's the idea of fate and then also the illusion of fate. The idea of a romanticized past and the idea that it is just a romanticized past and it might not have ever been this. When you say there's a good guy and a bad guy, I would argue that there is a guy who is good in the sense that he is working on the side of justice, in so much as there is justice in America, or however you want to look at it.
I think Tommy Lee Jones in this movie is about as good as a sheriff you're ever going to meet on the silver screen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's good.
He's 100%, he's 100% protagonist. In fact, is there anything he does in this movie that makes you think, he's a little bit morally gray?
No, but I also don't think we see a bunch of him.
Moreover, is Anton Chigurh the most villainous person we've ever met on screen? It's possible that he's the most villainous person.
And that's, I think, what I want to get at is why I also say it breaks the Western trope. There's good guys and there's bad guys in Westerns. This guy's pure evil, right? And
that's right.
Maybe even so much to the point where there's almost like there is no the amorality is larger than the immorality. And that creates a different type of villain. And whereas most Westerns, it's like, you know what the bad guy's motivations are.
Interesting.
And it's usually he wants to rob, he wants the money, he wants power, he wants that. Right. Yeah, and with Anton Chigurh, it's just, he is just, like I said, he operates with no clear, you can't anticipate his moves because there's no clear motivation for it, right? And so he has a code.
He certainly has a code. I think that he views himself in an amoral way. I don't know if that makes him immoral, but I think he feels like I'm an instrument of fate in the same way that the coin is an instrument of fate. And so it's not really on me to decide whether these people live or die. That's just the way fate works. And I just happen to be the guy who's the right tool for this. But I think from everyone else's perspective in the movie, and in my perspective as a viewer, it's not amoral. That guy's evil as fuck, you know?
Sure. For sure. And I agree. I'm just talking about it from a Western versus anti-Western perspective is that also he doesn't wear a hat. And so I also think that's important because he's not the villain in the black hat.
If I had Joey Lawrence
hair from Gimme a Break, I would probably I'd tuck that under the biggest hat I could find.
I want you to know that after watching the movie this time, I thought I could pull it off for Halloween. If I had the right wig, I could absolutely go as Anton Chigurh. All right, let me ask you this.
Well, and I guess also, too, with the anti-Western concept, while, yes, Tommy Lee Jones and Javier Bardem are sort of your good at versus bad, and you, like I said, Josh Brolin's Llewellyn is kind of just a side character. In a Western, the guy who finds the money and who has the wife to protect is a hero.
Oh, sure.
And so they do deconstruct that very carefully in the sense that it's like, well, this is just how it goes.
All right, let me ask you this. So the umbrella of Western, would anti-Western fall underneath that umbrella? Is an anti-Western a Western?
By definition, you know, is it a subset of the Western genre? Like you can't have an anti-Western if you don't have a Western concept, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this might be kind of a splitting hairs type of situation, because I do agree that like it follows. Because it's actually the first thing I wrote down in my notes was, is this a Western?
And oh, good. Because I wanted to ask that question. I didn't even write it down. It occurred to me, oh, this is a Western. Doesn't matter that the cowboys are in cars most of the time. This is certainly a Western. And then I thought, is this the best Western? And then I thought, it's interesting that this takes place in a lot of hotels. That was a little joke for you.
Yes, I appreciate that.
And I'd like to introduce our new sponsor, Best Western Hotels. I was thinking this is the best Western ever made. And then I thought, Butch and Sundance is on my top 10. There's a lot of Westerns out there. Then I thought, Butch and Sundance is so clearly an anti-Western in so many different ways. Maybe that's too bold of a statement, but then is this even an anti-Western? Isn't this just a straight good guy versus bad guy Western? And, you know, aside from sort of the anti-climax of this all, and it feels like it leans closer to Western than it does anti-Western. But you know, maybe that's just, like you said, maybe that's just splitting hairs.
And I think also it's the evolution of the Western genre, is sort of caught up in all of this too, because you start looking at certain things that, you know, if we paint with the brush of the old timey westerns, like a John Wayne type thing, I mean, it's interesting that we would kind of hold that up as the baseline, but we don't do that necessarily with other genres, and maybe that's an age thing.
But, I think it's an age thing. I mean, I think The Unforgiven was one of the first westerns I ever saw, and it happens to be one of the most famous anti-westerns.
Mm-hmm.
You are not a fan of westerns generally.
I've seen quite a few, but like I didn't watch any. I mean, I guess I've seen like Shane. You know, I guess if we're looking back at some of the older.
Yeah, I think that I watched Shane like in a classroom at one point.
Yeah, I was gifted Shane.
Oh.
From a brother-in-law who loved it, and I watched it and thought, okay. Yeah, I mean, I could probably even just like name them all off. I mean, if you're looking at the Young Guns movies, and like you said, Unforgiven, Hell or High Water, 310 to Yuma, the remake. Yeah, there's a few others that come to mind, and then questions things like, you know, do westerns have to take place in a certain time frame, right? That's another question. I think that's it's important to ask. Or is it just if there's cowboy hats, it becomes a western? Because this takes place, what, 1980?
1980, yeah.
Not typically a time when I would think of about old-timey western.
No, it's interesting, though. I think it's interesting that it is 1980, though, because it's right on the cusp of the end of the third generation of living memory. So oral historians have this concept of living memory, and it usually lasts about three generations. It's that you could have heard something from your grandfather who lived during the time of the event. Mm. Right. After that, if you want to learn about that period, you got to read something, or you've got to hear a story from a guy who heard a story. You know, these things get passed down. In 1980, you've got a character, and it's the guy you meet at the end, Uncle Ellis, who's in a wheelchair, who can recount an event that happened in 1909, which is, you know, sort of the end of the Butch and Sundance era. And so I think it's interesting that 1980 is chosen here, because it really allows the Tommy Lee Jones character to compare himself with what he calls the old timers. You know, there's still this oral tradition that's circulating about how the old sheriff, some of them didn't even have guns, and, you know, what it was like back when the heroic past were our relatives walking around. And that is about to die. All of that living memory is about to die with that last generation. And it's almost like, okay, now you're on a cusp. Like Butch and Sundance died in, you know, 1908. And so they died that one time, but they also die again when there's no one around that sort of carries that story in their living memory. And so I think 1980 is an interesting cusp of maybe it's the real end to the Old West. You know, could be that these old cowboys have been retired for years and years and years. Or maybe they're the sons of real life cowboys. But Tommy Lee Jones is in this weird bridge place where he can see what's on the horizon. He can see a future that looks totally alien to him. And yet he's carrying these family stories of what the Old West was like. And I think he starts to feel like, I've got more in common with my dead dad than I do with the youth of the next generation.
Sure. But then he wakes up. Okay. Now, because that is an interesting way to end it, right? So the question is, when he wakes up, is it because the dream is dead? The dream he had, but sort of the dream that he had, you know, so for where the world was headed or what it was? Or did he wake up because it is that like, and then I came to reality that was like, you know, none of that's real.
And so the dream was, it's interesting.
The dream that his father was like kind of making a path for him, right? And then that there would be a safety.
There
would be a comfort that would be like, hey, he's paved the way. It's like, turns out he didn't pave the way. Because so that's how I read it. I've read it multiple ways. The most recent one was just sort of the jarring, like, then I woke up, like, mostly like, hey, you know what? I had a fantasy, and then I just woke up in reality. Reality was too real to cling to this other notion anymore. My, you know, my father was the younger man in this particular scenario, because he's kind of like all suggesting, he's like, I've outgrown not only the age of my father, but maybe I've outgrown the fantasy of the world that my father lived in.
That's interesting. So he has two dreams. The first is that, and he remembers this one very vaguely. He thinks, I was in town, my father was a younger man, and he gave me some money and I misplaced it, which is interesting, because I think that there is something about sort of the corrosive nature of money in this film. That's a theme. Secondly, he's got this dream of his father who's making, like you said, making a way for him into the mountains, who's carrying fire and a horn, who's going to end up creating a trail fire down the road. And it could be viewed as kind of comforting, like his father's, it's waiting for him on the other side. I think that that's always how I've read it. Like, I've got more in common with my dad, and I clearly don't belong in this world anymore. But when I go beyond, you know, when I move on to the next life, I'll be more at home with my dead father. But the way that you're reading this, and it very well could be that that's the moral of the story, is that it was just a dream. He woke up. It's not real. What is the value of dwelling on this thing that's total fantasy?
Well, I think the dream is comforting in so much that it's a dream. And that's where the comfort has always lied. In the dream, in the fantasy, in the romance. And in a movie where there's no music, in a movie where there's nothing but tension, in a movie where there seems to be no order, I mean, that is, there, you can't pave a way in a world like that. You can't find comfort in a world with no reason. Either the world became this way, and it was something else at one time, and then now evil was invented in a new way, or it always was. And we were in, and if you're insulated from it, if you never had to run into Anton Chigurh and his coin flip, you might hear the music of the soundtrack of your life where you're the star. But until you run into it, you realize, well, maybe it's not, maybe that's always existed. And if it's always existed, then where were those rules? Where is the order? The order that I used to hang my hat on, the path that was laid, may not, it can be interrupted at any moment as long as there's an Anton Chigurh figure in this world. And I don't find that as, I don't find necessarily this movie saying that that's a new invention.
No, I think that that's an open conversation that the movie's having. Do you feel that way? All right, so let me ask you this. I've always been of the mind that old people lamenting the depravity of the next generation is folly. It's like, the old people have always been complaining about how the next generation sucks. Just that is as old as time, right?
Right.
I'm looking down the barrel of 50 now. You know, I'm getting to be that stage of life, and a little bit of it is creeping in. There's just a little bit of it that feels like, no, they kind of suck. And it was, boy, life was better back in 1980. Like, there's a little bit of me, not a lot of me, but there's a little bit of me that sees the virtue in that view. And I'm kind of, we're about the same age. How do you view this?
I think life was better in 1987 for me because I was younger and I wasn't old and I wasn't sore all the time and I wasn't falling, you know, chasing my own personal relevancy. I didn't know any better. So this is, I think, this is why, part of why I think generation gaps do this is because we do look back. But we look back and go, I had a better time, or this was better for me. And then we go ahead and we just say, and because I'm the star of my show, because I'm the center of my universe,
sure,
I can speak now and say that life was better then, and that means that these people are worse. The reality is, humans have always been disappointing.
All right. I think you're right. I think, and I, there's 99% of me that agrees with you. I'm going to just play devil's advocate for a moment. I'm looking at my son and the kind of assholes that he's being influenced by online, telling him that he needs to do a certain amount of kettlebell lifts and become a billionaire before he's 30 or he'll die poor. And just the amount, you know what? We may have freaking measles and polio back in the world. And I, you know, there's just little things like that, that you know,
little things like plague.
There's just little things like polio that make me think like, you know what? If only we could return to 1987, my son would have a much better life. You know, there's a tiny bit of me that's sort of starting to buy that narrative.
Well, I guess my counter to that is this isn't a people problem. It's not a new people. So this is where I'm going to go back to drawing this to the movie. So you have, like, I don't believe the movie is telling us that the Anton Chigurhs of the world are a new problem in 1980, and they weren't a problem in the old-timey West. I think what it's saying is that they were there, we just didn't encounter them. The internet shows us the Anton Chigurhs everywhere. And so what ends up happening is the musical soundtrack of our lives starts to dim because we start to run into these characters and these people, and they have a platform in a way that they don't have to travel to intimidate you. You just have to log on. So I don't think that
this movie was made in 2025. Anton Chigurh would be a YouTube influencer.
I was just going to say that very thing. Yes. So that's the thing too, with a lot of this is that access is the issue. I don't think it's, and so obviously that in it's like before, I mean, TV was the problem, right? TV was the problem. Mm-hmm. Because now all of a sudden you know, we're all stuck to the TV, and then, oh, now we know about bad news all over the world in a little more real time. Then the internet comes along and we know bad news before it even happens. And it's so access and information.
Yeah. According to my parents, Three's Company was going to teach me, that free love is a legitimate lifestyle. Even if I was going to live in LA with two women, it was going to corrupt me in some way.
It gave you the opportunity. It invited you to a world you didn't even know you had the option to. Right.
Or Cheers was going to tell me that hanging out in a bar could be a legitimate path in life.
Right.
You're right. You're right in that the conversations about what's going to corrupt the youth are always the same, but the content is evolving.
Absolutely. And so, here's the thing, and this is where the generation gaps become a problem, is that we take our 1994 sensibilities and we try to cram it onto our 2025 living children. And so we say there's a disconnect. Yeah, there is a disconnect because we don't evolve with it. And so is this matter of just trying to relate and understand, because we have to evolve with it. Yeah, you do want to be able to protect your kids, or you do want to be able to give them advice. But if you give them advice that's 30 years old, it doesn't make any sense.
That's all I got, man.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That's all I'm working with.
And but that's the generation gap, because we now are like, nobody, you know, like I can remember all of the things that like were said to me that made it easier for me to just check out from my parents' so-called knowledge, because I'm like, well, that's not the world that I'm living in. The world you're talking about is not the world that I'm about to embark on.
Yeah.
And then we live that world and we're focused on it, and then a new world shows up and we're like, well, wait a minute.
So in most of this movie, Tommy Lee Jones is under the impression that he's dealing with a new kind of evil. And he's overmatched, and he's thinking about retiring because he's just thinking, I don't know if I have it in me to go all in this fight. I think that there would be some kind of hazard to my soul if I'm going to try to fight this new evil. And then toward the end, he meets his Uncle Ellis, and this is what Ellis says.
What you got ain't nothing new. This country's hard on people. You can't stop what's coming. It ain't all waiting on you. That's vanity.
That's vanity. Which mm-hmm. is kind of what you've been arguing. So you've been taking this view that's like, well, yeah, if you're vain enough to think that you're the main character, then the world's gonna seem out of joint when you get to be older and the next generation takes over. And what Uncle Ella says is, he's like, that's kind of vanity, man. There really is nothing new, which I think is a not so subtle echo of Ecclesiastes.
Totally, yes.
And so if there's nothing new under the sun, there's no such thing as a new evil. It's just that you've got to change your perspective and realize that the world is different than what you always thought it was. But it's interesting that they're having this conversation, because I don't know if Tommy Lee Jones's character is convinced by this, which means that I kind of feel like the dream conversation at the end is kind of ambiguous. But I think Uncle Ellis's voice is kind of the voice of the Coen brothers in this movie.
Right.
They view it in that way. I don't know if it's convincing to Tommy Lee Jones.
Well, and I think that that's the important part of the ending. This is why I'm now stuck on the "and I woke up" read. I don't think he is necessarily saying, "and I woke up to the reality that this was just a dream." But I believe he says, "I woke up." The movie ends abruptly at that moment, because that's it. Like, that's like whether or not he makes that connection. Like, he's just talking, like, because the dreams don't matter much. Like, there was the other thing he kind of said, like, dreams only kind of matter to the person that they're intending to be about, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of goes with that same idea that says, hey, well, star of the show, I'm the star of my own dream. My dream may not necessarily sound interesting to you because it's my dream. And it was
right.
It's always
interesting to the one who's experiencing it.
Right. And so he tells it, and then I woke up. And then, like, the way that the movie ends to some, I mean, like, it's a very abrupt ending that almost just goes to say, and now this part of is over. What's next and it's a very unsettling and like for me, this, like I said, the moral of the story is like, there is no moral. And
I'm not sure about that. Let me ask you this. Do you think that Anton Chigurh is supernatural in some way in this movie?
I will say he is, whether or not he's intended to be sort of like the character in Raised in Arizona, the motorcyclist.
He was horrible. A lone biker of the apocalypse. A man with all the powers of hell at his command. He could turn the day into night and laid to waste everything in his path.
I would say that, and this is where maybe the anti-Western conversation come in handy, is that, like, we say there's a good guy, there's a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Anton Chigurh is a terrifying individual, but he's a more terrifying idea. And so
he's Batman.
Well, kind of, because he ushers in for all the people that he's encountered, especially the older folks. Right. Interesting. I think watch who he interacts with and how that control works. And then the difference in maybe when he talks to the younger folks.
Interesting.
And the way that they sort of negotiate or try to negotiate, but they're trying to explain through like a reason and rationality. You don't get that necessarily on the older side. At least yeah. with this encounter in the like the gas station, you have this it's an affront. This idea that this person can be like this doesn't follow the rules. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute. And like we said, he leaves. You may have survived, but now you're introduced to a concept of villainy that really wasn't on your radar because it doesn't follow any rules. And if it doesn't follow any rules, then now you have a bigger issue. What are the rules? And were they ever any good? What have I lived my life for? So these become the existential questions that can start to flow out of an encounter with an Anton Chigurh. And when you have a Tommy Lee Jones character, it's like, look, I'm under the impression you will go and you will find a bad guy and you will find his motivations and you will beat him off the pass and then you will arrest him and then justice will be served. But if that's not an option for some of these villains and some of the evil that's out there, what am I doing? What has any of this been about? Like, that's the place where you can end up. And so if Anton Chigurh supernatural, even if he's not physically a supernatural person in this movie, he's a supernatural concept especially for this generation.
So this week I decided to read No Country for the first time. And so, you know, famous Cormac McCarthy novel,
a typically upbeat author.
Right. I mean, I moved through the book pretty quickly, so I guess I should say that I enjoyed it. I don't know if his style is my favorite, but when I read the book, I never got the sense that Anton Chigurh was like supernatural in any way, but he is called a prophet of destruction in the book. So that's interesting. And he does sort of represent kind of like the kind of new evil that someone like, you know, Tom Ed is going to feel overmatched by. I do think that the Coen brothers like to pepper in a little bit of supernatural in their movies.
Yeah.
And I think that that is probably a departure from the book. There's a couple scenes that happen in hotels where it creates this tension by sort of wrong-footing the viewer. Like, either you think he's going into a room that he's not going into, or the timeline is messed up in a way, but the way that the scenes are cut together, it creates a sense of menace. So you got that first hotel scene where it's like, you know, can I get the money out when I know that that guy is in the room across the way? And, you know, Anton Chigurh is going to come in and he's going to blow everyone away, but you realize... he's going in the wrong room and he ends up killing these other hitmen. So you've got that. And then you've got a couple other hotel scenes, but you got the one near the end where you're not sure, is he behind the door at the same time that Tommy Lee Jones is going into the hotel room at the crime scene? And he goes in the room and he's just gone. And he goes to the window. The window's latched, so he didn't go out the window. And maybe he just vanished, or maybe that scene was cut in a way where it was sort of like inside the hotel is happening at the different time than what's going on outside of the hotel. So I'm not sure what I'm supposed to think about this. And it makes me wonder, like, do you think Anton Chigurh was behind the door when Tommy Lee Jones was going into the hotel room?
I don't think it matters.
Yeah, but how did you experience it the first time?
The first time I thought he was.
So you thought he was, and then he was gone, and then what did you think? Like, did you think, dude, that guy up and vanished? Or you think, oh, they tricked me again?
I'm more on the I think they tricked me again kind
of. Yeah, thing. That's how I felt too.
Yeah, I also think, yeah, and I think the movie does so much to just like it is disorienting, and so much so that I mean, yeah, we look back and we've seen this movie several times, and we say, yeah, Llewellyn is just a sort of an ancillary character. It's like, but that's not how the movie is structured, and the movie is structured the way that the Coen brothers decide to structure this movie. Is part of the framing of this piece of art, right? I mean, it's in you are focused on Llewellyn, and he is the star of this movie, the same way we think we are the star of our own movies, and then he's just sort of dismissed, very anticlimactically.
Yeah, we don't even see it happen. It happens. We don't see it happen. Screen. And
he's just as much a body that is found as the bodies he found that started his whole adventure.
That's right. Yeah. That's
and then that's it. And I mean, I don't know how many times Heather and I have seen this movie, and even she was like, he's just dead. and I think that they're doing this all because this is the story I believe they're trying to tell. And they decide to tell it in such a way that you go, well, he just dead. I've invested all this energy to see what's going to happen, and he's just you don't even show him die, and it's like, and then you realize, ah, that's exactly what this movie's telling me. This is the world we live in.
Yeah,
from a certain point of view, right? I mean, yeah, you're the star of your own show, but you might be the only one watching it.
So okay, he dies in a way that is like the filmmakers don't even capitalize on the drama of his death. So that's just filmmaking malpractice right there, right? It's all like, dude, you're rooting for this guy at this point. You need him to protect his wife. You need this to happen. If you're going to kill him, then you better squeeze as much emotionality out of that death as you can, right?
Right.
Both Cormac McCarthy and the Coen brothers are like, no. No. Yeah. We're going to do it different. And we know that this is not how it's normally done. And we think this will work just fine. Right. And because of that, it's more jarring than anything else. It's because you're sort of reeling with, wait, did I see? Did I fall asleep for 10 minutes? Like, what did I miss? Wait a second. Now I'm in my head for the next 10 minutes just thinking, wait, they couldn't have just really done that, right? So it's almost like the non-violence or the non-climax is more memorable because we've been trained to think of a Western in a particular way.
Right. And then again, like you become, because you're like, okay, well, you know, movie rules, mm-hmm. The movie rules are that, okay, if you have him dead, you're going to show me that. You're going to still show me in a flashback or a discussion or maybe in an interrogation scene. And when none of that happens, you go back to, what good are the rules if the rules brought you here? And it's like, these rules, the movie breaks rules. The movie breaks Western rules to tell us that the Western romance is folly. And I think that that's what it's doing. So it has to be, you know, again, a Western can be an anti-Western because you need to compare it to something. Mm-hmm. And I think there's too many rules that are starting to be established that are broken so dramatically that to me, really, the dream he has or the waking up of the dream is also part of the anti-Western, right? It's all part of this. Yeah, the world may have white hats and black hats, but those are just hats.
One of my favorite parts of this movie is, and it happens after that coin flip scene, when Anton Chigurh goes into the property manager's office. And she's like, we aren't allowed to give out information. And he's just like, it's like he runs into a brick wall. It's right. Like, Even the prophet of destruction cannot overcome red tape.
Right, right.
I just think that's a fantastic, beautiful, and I do not remember that in the book. I could have missed it, but I think that was a Coen Brothers edition. Really, really funny scene, and it sort of adds. And also, you know, Tommy Lee Jones, all of his interactions with his sort of bumpkin deputy, like legitimately funny, legitimately funny. And
oh yeah.
I'm not, you know, I don't worship cowboys or whatever. I've got no affinity with the Old West or whatever. But there's just something about Tommy Lee Jones's voice that just makes me want to talk and walk like him.
Oh, yeah.
It's like that. There's just something about that that's mesmerizing.
Well, I think the idea that he carries himself as somebody who's just kind of tired and over it. Like, I relate to that in a way that I didn't used to.
Probably I don't. You know, it's just the whole thing that says.
I love the when he's with the deputy, he's talking about the couple in California.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how, you know, they would just, you know, bring in these old folks and kill them for their Social Security money. But they tortured them, you know, and then. They don't know why, you know, and he's explaining the story and he talks about, he's like, it wasn't until, you know, so one of the guys was running naked with nothing but a dog collar on that the neighbors decided to complain. He says, isn't that something? You know, that's what it took to get him to pay attention, not all digging graves in the backyard. And then like the deputy kind of laughs and he's like, yeah, it's okay. Yeah. I laugh sometimes too. but it's like that sequence is just like it's you're seeing a man just sort of just trying to wrestle with the idea, like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And he's like, why? And he says, you know, why are they torturing him? He's like, he says, you know, maybe it was that there was nothing on TV. And I think that's an interesting moment. Like, we had our little conversation about, you know, like perception of television. And here it is, 1980, and for him to say that kind of feels pretty authentic in this idea that, like, he's kind of blaming TV, you know, or you know, bringing it to light that, you know, that's kind of the dumbing down of humanity to some degree. Like, it's kind of baked in there.
Yeah, he's really trying to make sense of the world, and I think that he just can't help but say it in an interesting or funny way, just because that's who he is. I also like when he says,
"Oh. Now that's aggravating.
Sheriff?
I'm still sweating.
Oh, Sheriff! We just missed him! We gotta circulate this on radio.
All right. Well, what do we circulate?
Looking for a man who has recently drunk milk?
there's just little things about that that make you think, you know, maybe I am that old cowboy, like, way deep down inside. I don't know if you know this, my grandfather, my dad's dad, he was a sheriff's deputy on horseback. He used to ride around Orland, California, and he looked a lot like Tommy Lee Jones. Like, I could be related to Tommy Lee Jones.
Coverage varies by plan, view contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If your car is out of warranty, one major repair bill could wipe you out. Just ask Ludacris.
Car breakdowns can wreck your wallet. Without endurance, a worn-out timing belt could cost you $1,700. A busted transmission? That's $4,000 easy. An engine meltdown? $7,000. But if you've got endurance, you could never pay out of pocket for a car repair again. With endurance, your car's most expensive parts are covered. Plus, you pick the mechanic you trust to do the work. With endurance, your rate stays the same no matter how many claims you file.
If your car is under 20 years old, Endurance has you covered with unlimited miles. Plus, your plan includes 24/7 roadside assistance anywhere in the country.
So who's going to pay for your next breakdown? You or Endurance?
Choose the name Ludacris trusts. Endurance. Right now, get $300 off any plan, plus a year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free. All backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get your free quote at endurancewarranty.com. That's endurancewarranty.com.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.
Was there a cliche device or trope in this movie that you enjoyed?
The haggard sheriff and the wide-eyed deputy.
Oh, that's beautiful. Always love that. I think that this movie does better than any other movie the scene where the badass blows up the car and walks away and doesn't look at the car. You know, that scene is so tropey. You know, that you're so cool that you're not even going to turn around or flinch at the explosion behind you. But this works even better because it's his plan. He knows that 99% of the public, their eyes are going to go right to the explosion, and that's going to create a diversion so that I can go get the medical supplies I need.
Right.
So they do that. It's so tropey and it works so well. And then they go right into something I've never seen in an action movie before. He takes all of his supplies. He goes to a hotel room, lays out plastic, and performs surgery on himself. And that scene is as terrifying to me as any other scene in the movie.
Well, yeah,
it just reminds you, like, look, you think you're an old cowboy. There's no way you're performing surgery on yourself.
Right. There's a very, like, it feels very Terminator-ish.
Yeah, that's right.
Like,
yeah.
When the Terminator goes in and, like, is fixing himself what that adds in Terminator is this idea that's like, oh, he's smart enough to fix himself? Well, geez, it's not even as simple as just, like, right, shoot at him or chop him up or whatever, like... As long as the brain is still moving, he will fix himself. And so that element adds sort of, you know, so it takes some of the supernaturality off of Anton Chigurh because it shows that there's weakness and that he has to do this work. And but it also shows that he can, you know, he may not be superhuman, but he's an exceptional human in that regard. And so I think that's what also the car accident sort of establishes too, right? I mean, I think that's an important key moment is this, he's not indestructible. You know, it does show he's a person and he's also subject to the happenstance and the random occurrence of life. Mm-hmm. And while he may be in control so much as he's still kind of the star of his show until a car hits him, you know what I mean? It's like, there is an interesting moment there where it doesn't relieve the situation, but that's probably the most hopeful moment in a movie that to me is all about the lack of it.
That's interesting. That
it's like, the good news is, as bad as evil can be, evil sometimes can also get in a car accident.
That's a very Coen Brothers thing to do at the end of a movie, like to bring in a natural disaster or something that's sort of a field leveling event, whether it's a major flood or a tornado or something like that, to kind of remind the audience, like, you've been following this story, but there's something bigger in the world that's at work that kind of reduces the story in a way. Mm-hmm. And, I just think it's a very kind of Coen Brothers thing to do at the end of a movie.
Yeah. So in terms of like a trope, I feel that's also a trope that I enjoy, but it feels specific to the Coen Brothers.
Yeah. 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 It's more like a artistic flourish, I suppose. Was there a tweak you would have made to this movie to improve it?
I don't know, man.
Pretty perfect.
It's pretty great. Like, I don't know that I don't think there's a moment in the movie where I was like, I could have done without that or do this different. You know, I mean, it's,
yeah,
I really don't. I mean, if for the story it's trying to tell, I don't, put it this way. I don't feel qualified.
So the one thing which has been solved by subtitles, but I remember the first time I saw this in a theater, I remember thinking, boy, I really wanted to understand what that guy just said. What that guy just said must have been really important, but it was like all Southern mumbly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the first time I saw this, I thought, damn, I got to see that again with subtitles, because there was a lot that I just kind of missed in the dialogue. So I don't know if that's something that that really you can do and continue to keep kind of the Southern realism of this movie.
Right.
Did you watch this with subtitles?
No.
You feel like you got everything?
I think so. I mean, there are definitely moments where I was like rewatching this. I was like, "What the? Wait, what did I say?" Like, I'm like, "Am I gonna have to do this the whole movie?" But then, like, I feel like I caught on.
Sarah does not like subtitles. I almost just watch everything with subtitles now.
I don't like it because I can't not read it. I mean, I know, like, even if I know what it's being said, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I feel about reading.
I mean, it's I just feel like. I'm the old man, so why not just lean into it? Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
Ooh, yeah, this is like it feels like it's so Coen brother-ish, it's almost unfair to try to ask somebody else to do it. But I mean, because we have, you know, we're beholden to our grading system, I would say it's a Howard plus 8.
Yeah, I was going to say Howard plus 5. I could see, like, you know, this movie came out the same year that There Will Be Blood came out, right?
Yeah.
There's famous stories about them shooting in the same city and sort of the cast and the set colliding with each other in kind of interesting moments. I could see PTA doing this. You know, I could see Tarantino. It would definitely feel different. Right. I could see someone else taking this book and adapting it for television or adapting it for the screen. I think that the Coen brothers are uniquely qualified for this particular story. And some of the themes that are in the Cormac McCarthy book are themes that they are dealing with in their other movies anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't change that for anything.
Yeah, because like I said, I think it feels very hopeless in many ways, and I think they do hopeless fairly well. But a lot of times they'll treat hopelessness as sort of an absurdity. Whereas with this, but I think, like I said, that car accident scene, I think is very effective to, like I said, to be the most hopeful part of the movie. I mean, in one hand, it says, look, you know, this guy's not, you know, evil won't be stopped by a guy in a white hat. Evil's going to be stopped by the world that created it, and or not, but it's got as much of a fighting chance as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Is there a Kevin Bacon character that could be inserted into this movie and enhance the movie in some way?
Enhance it? Well, let's see. Maybe we can take the crooked chief from Beverly Hills Cop 4 as Axel Foley. And have him somewhere. Maybe he's working sort of with Woody Harrelson, Stephen Root in some way.
I like that. Yeah, the cops in this movie they're not necessarily dirty.
Right.
They're just kind of like old racists, you know?
Yeah.
Which makes you dirty in a different way, but it is a sort of a departure. It's like, no, this is just how most cops are. They think that they're good. They might be, you know, old racists who don't really understand the way the world works anymore. But you know, in their world, they're respected men. They're, you know, they're upstanding men of society. Is there a half the battle, one to grow on moment in this film?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned it earlier. It's just, you know, nothing matters.
I don't know if I agree with that. We don't usually take this question seriously, but I think that there's something to be said about how the sins of your father are still going to haunt you in the present. Like, I think that there's something about the Vietnam War that hangs over this. These are violent men who conquered the West. And they're violent men who took on the Nazis. And they're violent men who went to Vietnam. And they're violent men who, you know, are battling the forces of the drug runners. And that violence doesn't go away. That violence can kind of corrupt you deep down in your DNA. And it's going to creep up on you in some way. And so maybe this is the violence that you sowed in this soil, and it's coming back to get you. I think that there's something about that in this movie.
And so what?
Yeah, I think also, because it is 1980, I think that there is something about, like, hey, don't take the money. Go get that antelope, dude. That's what you came here for.
Yeah.
You didn't go out there for $2 million. You went out there for an antelope. Your life and your wife would have continued if you just brought home the antelope. I think it is interesting at the end when Sugar, pays the kids for the shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And he's walking away, and you think, you think sort of like, well, karma got him. You know, that's fantastic. The two kids start fighting over the money.
Right. Yeah.
And it almost, I mean, going to your point, it's like, does it really matter? These boys started out so altruistic. It's like, hey, you can have my shirt for free. But as soon as you got $100 in your hand, it's like, dude, I'm out of shirt.
I'm the one who's out the shirt, not you.
So there is something about money that's going to, you know, corrupt any kind of altruism. I think that that's also a moral to this story. What a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it really is. And similarly to my experience when we rewatched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is I kind of was jonesing to watch it again right after. This one maybe a little less so, just because it's you kind of need a smoke break.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But when you watch something that, like, when something's done so well, you know, it's like, that's the interesting thing about like a certain art, right? Like you can like, how long is too long to stare at a painting you love, right? And the answer is there's no time limit, you know, but you can walk away, you come back to it, you walk away, come back to it. You want it in the house because you want to see it, you know, it inspires you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something like this, it's nice to be able to take little parts of it and be able to watch it and appreciate it in such a way. But it does, you do want to just kind of stare at it a little bit more.
So, like I said, I wanted to kind of get a new perspective on this movie, which I've seen quite a bit. So I read the book this week. I'll be honest, man, it's one of those rare times where the movie is just better than the book.
Interesting.
And it's all about the Coen brothers. Like, they're going to find someone who delivers a line just perfectly. They're going to bring a little bit more humor to it. They're just so capable at what they're doing that it's hard not to think, well, that's just a masterpiece.
This is the way it should be.
This is the way it should have been all along.
cocoon of horror.
Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC. Used with permission.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.